The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or the travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. When you think of the nation's capital, what places would you like to visit were you to take a trip to Washington, D.C.? The Smithsonian, the Capitol, the White House? Even if you were fortunate enough to get passes for a White House tour, there is a good chance you would not see some of the inner workings that only a select few are privileged to experience. One such restricted location is the White House Situation Room. Writers Tony Capaccio and Jennifer Jacobs recently reported that the outdated White House Situation Room is getting a needed overhaul. Now, their article appeared in the October 2, 2021 extra edition of the News and Observer. Before we begin their story, let me share a caption from a photo of the Situation Room that accompanies the article. In this photo, we see the president and his advisors seated around a conference table in a well-lit room, much like a typical corporate conference room, surrounded by windows and glass walls and other features. And it reads, President Joe Biden speaks with his national security team during an August 22nd briefing about the Afghanistan withdrawal in the White House Situation Room in Washington. The Pentagon has proposed shifting almost $46 million previously approved for other programs to accelerate an ongoing overhaul of the Situation Room, a series of rooms, including a command center on the lower level of the White House's West Wing for the president and senior administration officials to conduct secure briefings and calls. Let's begin the article now. It's the highly secure space in the White House where presidents have gone to watch video feeds as U.S. forces killed terrorist Osama bin Laden and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. It's where President Joe Biden learned in August that a suicide bomber killed 13 American service members in Kabul. But the Situation Room is also a technology throwback with some equipment that hasn't been updated in 15 years. Now the Pentagon has proposed shifting almost $46 million previously approved for other programs to accelerate ongoing overhaul and adding about $44 million backed by Congress for the project since fiscal 2017 and $10 million requested for fiscal 2022, according to Pentagon budget documents. The Situation Room is actually a series of rooms, a command center on the lower level of the White House's West Wing for the president and senior administration officials to conduct secure briefings and calls. SIT room staff provide 24-hour monitoring of international developments, according to their nonprofit White House Museum. A person familiar with the operation, who discussed the secure facility on condition of anonymity, said its staff also connects calls with heads of state and monitors major domestic events. Funds are required for renovations that will update the security and technology since the last renovation in 2006, including audio-visual improvements to enable broadcast quality display and production capability to include flexible infrastructure for rapid upgrades, according to a Defense Department budget document for fiscal 2022. The money sought for improvements will continue to upgrade and secure critical systems that support classified voice, data, and video used in the White House Situation Room and throughout the National Security Council for the President, Vice President, and senior staff, according to the document. Not surprisingly, much of what spending will support is classified, like the full capabilities of the Situation Room itself. Some of the funding would also upgrade systems used at locations outside Washington, known as continuity of government sites, that were created during the Cold War in case of a catastrophic attack on the nation's capital. The Pentagon request to shift funds to the Defense Information Systems Agency for the Situation Room is part of a reprogramming request for unspent fiscal 2021 funds that Congress is reviewing. In addition, $10 million is being requested as part of the still-spending fiscal 2022 budget, according to agency spokesman Dylan McConnell. Intelligence agencies also are participating in the upgrade and its funding. The person familiar with the project said. The multi-layered system includes equipment such as servers at off-site locations and is protected by layers of backup, encryption, and hardening against physical attack, the person said. The Situation Room has been the site of many tense and historical moments since it was created in May 1961 out of frustration on the part of President Kennedy after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, according to the White House Museum. During President Donald Trump's term, the White House released an October 2019 photo of him in the Situation Room watching the commando raid that killed al-Baghdadi, the Islamic State leader in Syria. It has also been the site of less momentous events. In December 2017, it's where Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, fired Trump advisor and former Apprentice celebrity Omarosa Meningo-Newman. Despite the room's reputation for tight security, she secretly taped the conversation. This year, Biden and his team were gathering for an update on the airlift evacuation from Afghanistan when he learned of the August 26 terrorist attack at Kabul Airport. As the president arrived in the Situation Room, one of the first updates he received, of course, was about the attacks on the ground in Kabul, Press Secretary Jen Psaki said at the time. Commanders on the ground and the region, using the secure communications link to the nerve center at the White House, gave Biden briefings as updates rolled in. The most famous photo was that when White House photographer Pete Sousa called Frame 210, taken on May 1, 2011. President Barack Obama and his national security team watching a live drone video beamed into a laptop and listening to a satellite radio feed of the SEAL Team 6 raid that killed bin Laden, the mastermind of the September 11 attacks. The image shows Obama and top advisors crammed together in a small room. Air Force Lieutenant General Brad Webb, who was a one-star general and an Air Force tech sergeant for the secretive Joint Special Operations Command, explained in an interview how that came about. Webb, who's now the three-star commander of the Air Education and Training Command, said he was told by White House staff that he wasn't authorized to have access to the president, but you can set your stuff up. If we have a question, we'll come and get you. So Webb and a tech sergeant operated a laptop in a small annex in the Situation Room complex to monitor the raid in Pakistan. Then everybody kind of naturally migrated, and they flowed in over the series of hours, he said. First was then Vice President Biden, who asked, "Hey, General, what's going on?" I kind of walked him through what he can expect, Webb said. Then it kind of got busy, Webb said. He said he looked around and found, whoa, everybody's in here, including Obama, who let Webb keep his seat. Webb is seen in uniform in the center of the White House photo. I spent a lot of time explaining to them what was going to occur, but as more people came in, I just unplugged the laptop headset so they could hear the audio. That included the now-famous Geronimo Ikaya call sign by a commando on the ground signaling that bin Laden was dead. Sousa later wrote that the president stood up to shake hands with General Webb and a few others, but there was no cheering or fist-bumping. It was an oddly subdued reaction to a historic moment. Well, next we depart the White House Situation Room and head for Maryland, where we will visit a couple of unique sites. First, Christina Tkacek of the Baltimore Sun is going to tell us about the ramshackle log cabin restored to shed light on black history. Now, her story appeared in the October 15, 2021 issue, extra edition issue, of the News and Observer. Opening the mustard-colored door of a little log cabin in Hagerstown, Maryland, a visitor feels like a homeowner in an HGTV special just before the big reveal. You know how it goes. Ooh, ah. Well, inside, it's a makeover that would impress any viewer or fixer-upper. Well, the little house isn't the product of a one-hour TV special. Instead, it's the culmination of a year-long collaboration between preservationists who hope the house in Hagerstown's historic African-American community will spark the revitalization of the surrounding neighborhood. It also might just change the way people look at houses. After all, the once ramshackle structure at 417 Jonathan Street turned out to be one of the oldest buildings in the city. The cabin and its history was nearly lost for good. In 2018, a police cruiser crashed into the home, rendering it uninhabitable, we should say. It was only when crews discovered historic-looking wood timbers that they realized just how old this house was and how that made it potentially worth saving. Reggie Turner, a Hagerstown financial advisor who sits on the Maryland Commission on African American History and Culture, said he had seen too many of the area's old buildings face the wrecking ball. While Maryland's Eastern Shore is celebrated for its connections to black history, homes to giants like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, Turner says Jonathan Street, a thoroughfare in one of the state's oldest free black communities, is of equal significance. He wants to see tourism focus on the historic sites in the area, including where prominent black businesses and churches once stood. Working with the Western Maryland Community Development Corporation, Turner helped broker a sale of the cabin to Preservation Maryland. "We have a neglected historic black community with a rich history," Turner recalls telling the preservationist. "With some help, we could start turning things around." Together, they were able to secure more than $250,000 from the state to fund the restoration project. Preservation Maryland CEO Nicholas Redding said his group, which celebrates its 90th anniversary this year, is increasingly focusing its attention on projects like this, ones that don't just keep buildings in amber, but make them useful for generations to come. Preservation Maryland is working with Habitat for Humanity of Washington County to find a prospective buyer for the Jonathan Street House. Their goal is to keep the structure affordable below its market value and to find a resident who will take care of it for the next generation. Redding thinks structures like the cabin show how vacant historic homes can be rehabilitated to create affordable housing. "We're too quick to throw away buildings," Redding said. "Projects like this need to be done to show people it is possible. Tax credits could incentivize developers to restore such structures rather than build new ones." The group is partnering with the National Park Service to develop training programs for construction workers who want to specialize in historic preservation. While renovating the log cabin, the group made some fascinating discoveries. Although historians initially dated the structure to the 1830s, some of its materials are significantly older. The Oxford Tree Ring Laboratory, a firm based in Baltimore, performed dendrochronology to date samples of the home's timbers, determining that they were felled in the winter of 1739. Historical records indicate that there were just two buildings in the area that year, both log structures belonging to town founder Jonathan Hager. Redding called it highly likely that the cabin belonged to Hager. After that discovery, Redding said the project took on a new level of urgency as one involving potentially the oldest standing structure in Hagerstown. Today, the nearly 300-year-old beams are bare. In the bedroom, a wood panel was left exposed to display a penciled inscription discovered beneath newer drywall. Modern appliances and concrete countertops offset the rustic quality of freshly refinished hardwood floors. Trim-painted robin's egg blue ties a new addition to the rest of the house. Contractors raised the structure nearly a foot off the ground and added siding to protect the centuries-old wood. The project was overseen by Baltimore's Zeigarsneed Architects. Principal Ann Powell said she hopes the cabin will be a source of pride for community members along Jonathan Street and help raise awareness of the neighborhood's history. "Our hope is in attracting attention to the Jonathan Street project. It attracts attention to the whole Jonathan Street corridor," she said. "It's very clear that this is not intended to be gentrification." An archaeology team from the Maryland Department of Transportation, which researches significant sites around the state, excavated the ground around the cabin. Among their discoveries was a pierced dime believed to be a type of protective amulet and evidence of African Americans who lived there later on. City and census records indicate that some of the home's earliest residents were German immigrants. Its first black resident, Annie Bentley, likely moved in sometime around the 1880s. During segregation, Jonathan Street was a refuge for Hagerstown's African Americans and others passing through the area. Longtime resident Joanne Claiborne remembers when it was a thriving black business district with barber shops, a bowling alley, and even a hotel where Hall of Famer Willie Mays stayed while playing for the Trenton Giants. That hotel, as well as other Jonathan Street business, were listed in the Green Book, a guide for black motorists hoping to safely navigate the segregated South. Both buildings have been demolished. Sitting on her porch, Claiborne said a log building similar to the structure at 417 was demolished decades earlier. The site is now a lot where she parks her car. "A lot of historical homes have been torn down," she said. She's been glad to see the crew's progress on Jonathan Street's cabin and is hoped to hear about research that's been uncovered, such as the connection to Hager. History continues to turn up all the time on the property. During a recent visit, Redding paced through the backyard, picking up buttons and mismatched shards of blue and white china from the soil. Anna Scott has seen construction crews at work from her porch across the street. The 91-year-old Jonathan Street resident lives in a house built by her grandfather. Oh, they've done a beautiful job, she said of the renovations. Turner says he's watched progress from his car passing by on his way home. I'd ride through and check on our baby, he joked. Against all odds, we were able to bring in a partner and get this work done, he said. Preservation Maryland is also helping with the repair of a nearby community center, the Robert W. Johnson Community Center, where what was the first black pool in Hagerstown has been closed for years. This is not the end, Redding said. This is the beginning of something bigger. Well, from Hagerstown, we travel to Potomac, Maryland, where writer Eddie Dean tells us about a man whose collection of miniatures from around the world fills 16 rooms. Eddie's story was initially a special to the Washington Post and then was reprinted in the November 5, 2021 extra edition of the News and Observer. It's Sunday in a typical village in Venezuela. The mass in the cathedral is over and the market square is packed. There are fishmongers and queso fresco vendors and a newspaper hawker and kids playing hide-and-seek and other games, and in the center of the commotion, a cow that's parked itself near the church door. The figures are as small as Jorge Flores' eyeballs as he peers into the window of the barbershop like Gulliver in the Land of Lilliput. He points out an inch-high man getting a shave next to another tiny customer reading a newspaper. Then his eyes dart back out to the crowd, where he points to a girl in a ring around the rosy circle who's tumbling to the ground after losing her grip in the chain of hands. This is a very funny moment, the artist put in the scene, says Flores with an impish smile. That's what miniatures are all about, the details and the craftsmanship and the charm. This is art. It doesn't have to be Raphael to deliver a message of joy and fun. The elaborate and exuberant set of nearly 200 pieces, molded from clay and hand-painted in vibrant colors, was made by a woman in a craft shop in Caracas more than 50 years ago. It's one of thousands of such miniatures from around the world displayed in Potomac, Maryland, home of Flores, 74, who has spent a half century amassing his collection. There are strutting roosters from Portugal, a pearl from China handwritten with poetry, Navajo kachinas dancing in feathered ceremonial regalia, trolls from Norway, a marimba band from Mexico whittled from toothpicks, bronze gods and corn husk dolls from Nepal, model ships from Vietnam, an ebony Noah's Ark from Malawi, a half-inch Don Quixote twisted from a single strand of wire, a minuscule food dish from Thailand, a spotted cow from Germany licking its side with a tongue out of a Tex Avery cartoon, a sandalwood figurine from India of a Rajasthani woman in a traditional dress with hidden pocket drawers that reveal famous royal maharajas and epic battle scenes with warriors and elephants, and a street peddler from the Salvadoran town of Ilobasco. When you lift the lids of her pottery, there are also live armadillos for sale. Flores' vast mini-world fills 16 rooms. It's a staggering display of visually arresting objects that can be an overwhelming experience when you take the host-guided tour. Just when you think you've seen or maybe hallucinated it all, Flores ushers you yet into another room with shelves of more small-scale wonders waiting their turn in the spotlight. By his own estimation, there are between 80,000 and 100,000 figures in roughly 4,000 sets. Incredible as it may seem after viewing this stash, Flores is a discriminating finicky connoisseur who rejects most of what he comes across in his never-ending quest. He has strict criteria for what makes the cut. Piece has to be handmade and meet his standards of creativity and workmanship. Most important, it has to bring a smile to his face. Most of the sets come with a backstory about the artist and how Flores tracked the piece down in a far-flung part of the globe. Take one of his favorites, a set of carved wooden figures from Mozambique. It depicts a real-life event during a deadly flood in 2000 when a pregnant woman escaped the rising waters by climbing a tree where she gave birth. This set features the dramatic scene where she and her baby girl Rosita are rescued by helicopter. As with many of the countries represented in the collection, Mozambique is not just a place on a map for Flores. He worked on malaria vaccines with a clinic based there during his time as an infectious disease expert with the National Institutes of Health. In the last decade, his collection has more than doubled in size, and he has become a patron as well as a collector. He and his partner Elizabeth, who accompanies him on search expeditions, have befriended many of the miniatures artists. One is the Jhangad family of Jaipur, India, who come from a long line of traditional woodcarvers. The exquisitely wrought figurines of the Rajasthani woman is one of the many pieces he has commissioned from the family. For Flores, it's a way of not only adding to his stash, but helping to financially support the practitioners of a dying art. They are poets, Flores says of the artist. They enjoy the work they do. It brings out their soul and goes into every piece they make. They have a lot of originality and craftsmanship, and they deserve to be known outside their villages. It was a homely frog prince, tiny as a thumbnail, that first helped spark Flores' obsession. He bought the German-made painted wood-based piece for 70 cents at a shop in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he was a clinical research fellow at Harvard Medical School in the early 1970s. It wasn't long before the completest streak of his miniature mania took hold. I think you have to have the passion for collecting that is kind of an unnatural gene defect, he told me. Collectors collect because they're curious and they want to bring things together and look at them all together. Let's say that I had the New York Yankees and little figurines handmade by a rural artist, and if I didn't have Mickey Mantle, it wouldn't be complete, right? You have to have everyone from the team. Quite an interesting visit there. Well, from Maryland, we're going to head south to Florida to visit a most unusual collection. Writer Paul Guzzo of the Tampa Bay Times lets us check out the Edward Scissorhands Museum inside the movie's Florida home. This article appeared in the October 15, 2021 extra edition issue of the News and Observer. And for those of you not familiar with the movie, Edward Scissorhands came out in 1990. It's a fantasy romance film directed by Tim Burton, and it starred Johnny Depp, and also Winona Ryder, just so you know. Here we go. We're in Lutz, Florida for this one. Mementos of her time on the Edward Scissorhands set have been stored in Tandova Asenia's attic since shortly after director Tim Burton yelled cut for the final time in 1990. I've been searching for a good home for them, says Asenia, a Tampa resident who was employed as a prop master on the Johnny Depp flick. In late September, she found one, the home where Depp's character with scissors for hands temporarily resided with the movie's Boggs family before faking his death and living in solitude in a castle. That house, at 1774 Ten Smith Circle on the Pasco County side of Lutz, was purchased a year ago by Joey and Sharon Lacalzi. The couple then opened it to the public as Scissorland, a museum dedicated to the quirky romance film. And by the way, the main character that Depp plays is a humanoid, and he has scissors for hands, just so you know. Those who want a tour should direct message to the Lacalzi's Instagram account, and you can do that. So if you're interested in taking a closer look at this, go on Instagram, instagram.com/official-scissorland. Again, instagram.com/official-scissorland. Epic was all a giddy Joey Lacalzi could muster as Asenia unveiled her contribution to the museum and told behind-the-scenes tales. Her gifts included an original script, an autographed photograph of Burton, a crew schedule, photographs of the construction team building the castle at the end of the cul-de-sac where the museum is located, the prototype for the paper dolls that Edward Scissorhands created in a scene, and a photograph of the full crew who worked in the Lutz neighborhood. I cleaned their dishes, Lacalzi said with a laugh. He was not joking. Lacalzi, who now builds guitar amp cabinets, has a unique connection to the movie. He worked at a nearby Denny's in 1990 when a producer stopped by with an offer. The movie's craft services department needed a kitchen in which to wash dishes and a dishwasher. Lacalzi volunteered for the added duty that spanned months. He was confined to the restaurant kitchen and never saw the set a few miles away, but I was proud to help, Lacalzi said, but my fans and family, they thought the story was stupid. The only person who cared was the previous homeowner of this house. Little more than a year ago, another house was for sale in the neighborhood. Its exterior was seen in the movie. We wanted it, Lacalzi said. It felt like destiny to live in the Edward Scissorhands neighborhood, but our bid was turned down. Then this house went on the market the very next day. Lacalzi made the first bid and told the realtor of his connection. That was all the previous owner, Susan Linville, needed to hear, Lacazzi said. She turned down cash offers because I was a dishwasher. Can you imagine that? But she knew I would appreciate the house. Weeks before officially closing for $230,000, Lacazzi and his wife were given the key so they could begin planning their interior design. During their initial visit, Lacazzi said five families of Edward Scissorhands fans were circling the block to get a glimpse of the house. I was like, come on in, Lacazzi said. Such vehicular fan traffic was a norm for the neighborhood, he said, so they came up with an idea to alleviate that issue while placating the fans. We decided to offer free tours, Lacazzi said. Contact us in advance, and we will let you inside, but don't circle the block. Tours are limited to the yards, kitchen, and family room. The bedrooms are off-limits because the Lacazzis live there, too. Fans have donated movie items to the home's decor, a piece of the actual mushroom wallpaper the home had during filming, a pair of scissors the crew used to trim the dinosaur topiary created by Edward Scissorhands in a scene, and a blade from the Scissorhands. The Lacazzis also covered the kitchen walls with new mushroom wallpaper and designed their own funky topiaries. The kitchen counters are old and should be replaced, Lacazzi said, but will remain because they date to the movie's production. Edward Scissorhands used these kitchen counters, Lacazzi said. Often fans donated original works of art inspired by the movie. Asenia provided the largest contribution yet, and her stories wowed the superfan homeowners. I wish she would write these all down for us, Lacazzi said. Asenia owned a business that rented and created props and sets for theatrical productions when she heard that a Hollywood movie was looking for a local crew. On my resume, she said, I outlined a pair of scissors. That is what got me the job. Asenia's primary jobs were to purchase the props and ensure they were on set and in the right place when the director yelled, action. But she had other duties added to her list. Depp was a chain smoker, Asenia said, but couldn't hold a cigarette with the scissor hands that took too long to take off, so I made a clip that could fix to the scissors and hold a cigarette, she said. When Depp discarded cigarettes on the road, neighborhood kids grabbed the litter. They were selling the butts for $5, Asenia said. When Edward Scissorhands unlocked the home's front door with his scissor hands, it was Asenia's job to open it from the other side. He was not really unlocking it, she said, and then added with a laugh, I guess that's what you call movie magic. And when Edward Scissorhands was trimming dogs or styling women's hair, Asenia was on the ground, tossing hair into the air for effect. Again, he was not really cutting hair, she said. Lacazzi's favorite tale involved the tented home scene for a moment in the movie. That was not part of the script, Asenia said. That home was actually being rented for termites. Burton thought it was great. She said she thought it made the neighborhood look perfect. Asenia estimates she spent 3 or 4 months on Edward Scissorhands, planning pre-production through the final scene. She had never returned to the neighborhood until the visit to the museum. It's an exciting job, she said, but it was still a job. I moved on and went back to my business. And she retired in 2018 and sold her warehouse inventory. Quite a story there, so you Scissorhands fans, those of you who may be, that's a place to visit too for you, okay? Well, that's going to bring an end to today's Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.